Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today, political journalist Tim Shipman talks about all our war.
Thank you very much for coming this wet afternoon. Tim has come down from Manchester to be here. He flew down and got here in the nick of time. And we're absolutely thrilled to have him here. He is the finest political journalist of his generation. He's also, I'm very proud to say, a friend of mine. And he has been a hack, fellow hack, for 20 years. According to your LinkedIn profile, I'm going to embarrass you. This is the bit I didn't tell you about in the preparation. Three wars, eight elections, three American, five British, and how many referendums is it now?
At least two.
Two so far. Probably another one.
I'm not sure we could cope with a third, but anyway.
Express, Sunday Express, Mail, Sunday Telegraph, back to the Mail as deputy political editor, and he's been the political editor of the Sunday Times since April 2014. When he was appointed, Martin Ivins, who I know is here on Monday, is he here today? The Sunday Times editor, said that Tim joins in what is sure to be one of the most interesting periods in British politics, which is a complete understatement. And the fact that he's written this fantastic book about Brexit, All Out War, available in Waterstones afterwards, is surely testimony to the fact that it has been a fantastically interesting time in British politics. A little bit more background. This is a history festival, and Tim, as well as being a journalist, is a historian. He read history at Cambridge, MPhil in international relations, and did you really have a GCSE in media studies?
I do have a GCSE in media studies.
So, actually, media studies is...
But as everyone will tell you, the worst way of becoming a journalist is to do any kind of media studies. It's much better to have a proper degree and then sort of fumble your way through. You need, as a wise man once said... A bit of literary ability and some low cunning are the key attributes. So I learnt a lot of that from Guy, frankly.
And finally, I just noticed again from LinkedIn, it said volunteering experience and causes Tim cares about, and it just says politics. And that's what we're here to talk about. You tweeted the other day, Tim, 1 year on from Brexit, and I've aged about 7 years.
Well,
it has been momentous.
It's been momentous. It's also been very tiring. Everyone talks about voter fatigue. They never talk about journalist fatigue. I mean, what most of us are spending our time doing at the moment is imploring members of the Conservative Party to let us at least have August off before they chop the Prime Minister's head off in September. So it's not clear yet whether we've been successful in that endeavour, but there's a lot of people who need to lie down, and it would probably aid the governance of Britain if all the politicians had a lie down as well, I think.
You covered Brexit for the Sunday Times, and then I remember you sort of disappeared for about 2 weeks, and then you ended up producing this book, which is 200,000 words long, very, very quickly. How, first of all, I just need to ask you a personal question. How do you find time, I know as an author, to write a 200,000-word book? Is it an understanding wife? And
well, I have a very understanding wife, and not sleeping also helps. The thing with the book was... As the saying goes, it's much quicker to write a long book than it is to try and write a short book. So I basically just did 4 weeks of interviews, interviewed everybody I could lay my hands on, and then spent 7 weeks cranking it out and hoping it came out in roughly the right order.
It's always said about journalism that you're writing the first draft of history, which is this sort of almost sort of pompous way of hacks trying to sort of justify that what they do is important. And then... Is there a difference between writing front page splashes to the Sunday Times and writing a book? Do you feel a different sense of responsibility, or is it identical in terms of...
No, I think it is a little bit different. I mean, with a newspaper, you're trying to write the most interesting thing you can find that week. You phone all your contacts, they tell you stuff. So this weekend, you know, I wrote a story about possibly Philip Hammond lining himself up to be leader of the Conservative Party, and that was based on, you know, several phone calls with people who were beginning to push this agenda. Does that mean it's going to happen? Would, in the full history of all of this in the end, is that going to look like a good story? I don't know. On balance, probably not, but it was the most interesting thing and the most accurate thing I could find to write that was happening that week. When you're doing history, the thing that I tried to do with this book, knowing that it was a hugely contentious issue which had completely divided the country, had divided families, had set a lot of my best friends at each other's throats, and just to give you a sort of example of that. I mean, my wife worked on the Remain campaign, and I was working for a newspaper that in the end declared for Brexit. I wrote a lot of stories that helped one side or another, and I had friends on both sides of the divide. And what I was determined to do when I came to write the book was to try and be fair to everybody and to explain what they were up to and why they wanted to do what they were doing, and try in each moment to give them their voice and let them explain why it was that they did the things that they did, and not try to be too judgmental about it. And with a couple of exceptions, the thing I've been most gratified about was that pretty well everybody on both sides came out saying A, that it was fair, and B, that they couldn't tell how I'd voted. So that meant quite a lot to me. But that's quite a difficult balancing act. And, you know, you've got a bunch of people who really loathe each other. And you're constantly having to sort of balance all that and try and work out how history will see this as well as, you know, the excitement of the moment.
When you're doing a political story, you're aware your interviewee has probably got some agenda to peddle, and they're going to use you, hopefully, to get that through. But when you're writing a book, were your interviewees, and your interviewees for this book are big names. I mean, they are all the key players. Were they aware of the fact that this was for a book as opposed to for another journalistic story? Did they change mode, if you like?
To some degree. I mean, the thing with everyone thinks I was working on this throughout the campaign. In fact, I decided to write it as I was standing at Theresa May's campaign launch, reading that email that had been sent to all the journalists by Michael Gove explaining why Boris Johnson was unfit to be Prime Minister. And I sort of thought, I already had a deal with HarperCollins to do something different, and I just emailed and said, we now have to do this book. And all the journalists had been sitting around going, well, who's going to write the campaign book? And we all decided we weren't interested in that. It was probably going to be quite a boring outcome, and we weren't. But at that point, I simply felt compelled to do it, and I was quite well connected, particularly with the Boris Johnson and the Michael Gove camps, and I thought, you know, I'm in a good position to do this. So I did all the interviews, actually, in the space of 4 weeks. I'd seen quite a lot of Boris. I'd been on 2 foreign trips with him throughout that year. So as part of the day job, you accumulate a lot of material. I had tapes of conversations that I'd had with people. I had tapes of interviews I'd done with people. But most of it was done there and then. And people become a little bit more forthcoming. When they think you're writing for the newspaper, they can be extremely cagey. And, you know, it's been known I've been doing a sequel for some time. And with some people who trust you, you can have a sort of 2-tier conversation where this is for the newspaper, this is for the book. But most of them, quite rightly and sensibly, don't trust you to keep that stuff out of the newspaper. So you have to have a conversation solely for the book. And the good thing about the referendum story was, because all the Cameroons, people I'd known for 10 years, were sort of, most of them were out of a job and lying dead in a ditch, they didn't have a great deal to lose by talking about it. I was fortunate in that I'd known Dominic Cummings, who ran the Leave campaign for some time, and I was fairly confident he would cooperate. But again, you know, I got one sit-down session with him, and then he disappeared off to the hills of Durham to read books on Bismarck, which is what he was doing before he changed our entire political landscape. So yeah, people do talk to you slightly more frankly. There is a slight pomposity about your sources as well as about journalists when you come to do a book. They do sort of think it's important to have, you know, a fair and equitable telling of history out there. And, you know, we've got the same situation now. There's a lot of people whose careers have not turned out exactly how they were planning a month ago, some of whom are planning to get the blame off themselves and put it onto other people. That Tory campaign is full of people who are determined not to be the person blamed for what has just happened. And some of them are becoming quite talkative in a way that they weren't while the campaign itself was going on.
Can we go back to the 23rd of January 2013, which was when David Cameron made his speech at the Bloomberg HQ in London? And he said, and this is when he announced that there might well be a referendum had they won an election. And he went, "Today, public disillusionment with the EU is at an all-time high. Democratic consent for the EU in Britain is now wafer thin. It will be a decision we'll have to take with cool heads. Proponents of both sides of the argument will need to avoid exaggerating their claims. We will have a time for proper, reasoned debate." Did that happen?
What do you think? I think we can, you know, politics doesn't often lend itself to yes-no answers, but the answer to that one is no, isn't it? And there was quite a lot else in that speech that didn't pan out as David Cameron was hoping either. He thought there was going to be treaty change in Europe and that would allow him to go and sort of put Britain's case. That all disappeared as well. He unveiled plans to fundamentally reform the European Union, and in the end, part of his problem was that he wasn't able to deliver on that either. It was a speech that raised a lot of expectations and didn't fulfil very many of them in the end.
But he then goes and wins this election in 2015. And where were you during that campaign? What was were you with the Tory battle bus, so to speak? Or?
Well, you were sort of chasing around after whoever was prepared to talk to you, really. I mean, that campaign, you know, I interviewed David Cameron, I interviewed Ed Miliband, I chased around after cabinet ministers. Campaigns aren't what they used to be. You know, in the old days when I first started out, there were press conferences every morning, there were policies being announced. These days, you know, a lot of people think that it doesn't pay to put themselves too close to journalists or the public, and you get a lot of controlled events where you go off as a sort of hand-picked group of party faithful or a business where they say, well, these people can ask us anything, but of course they've got their boss standing over them who doesn't want sort of embarrassing questions to the Prime Minister about why he's mucked up this or that. So that doesn't tend to be terribly illuminating. And the best hope you've got as a hack is that, you know, something random happens. Unfortunately, in every campaign I've ever covered, there's been a massive wobble where things have started to go wrong. Sometimes they pull it back together and, you know, in terms of the campaign we've just seen, things get worse and worse until the Prime Minister's aides all have to sort of throw themselves on their swords.
On the 9th of October 2015, you have the launch of Vote Leave. And what I'd forgotten about until I read your book was the fact that this figure of 350 million quid was at the very heart of it. The day it was launched, that figure was put out. That was the work of who?
Well, it was primarily the work of Dominic Cummings, who had realised that if you wanted to win, you needed simple messages and you needed to tap into sort of public rage at how we were sending lots of money to Brussels. And Cummings had done focus grouping ages before, in 2014. And if you go back and look at the blogs he wrote off the back of that, he talked about the need to have control, the need to go after the money, and the need to play the immigration card towards the end. And in actual fact, you know, 18 months, 2 years later, that's exactly what he did. And that figure was, a lot of people thought, not wholly accurate. It was a gross figure, not a net figure. But when it came to deciding which figure to go with, the guys who'd been doing Europe for years said, oh, you must go for 250 million because that's the net figure. And Cummings went, no, we go for the largest one. And if anyone disputes it, there'll be a big row. And every time there's a big row, it will remind the public that we are paying huge sums of money to Brussels. If you actually ask voters how much they thought we were sending to Brussels, it was a much, much smaller amount than the 350 million. Some people would say, what, 10 million a week or something? And they would then be staggered to discover that there was a debate about whether it was 250 or 350 million a week. And that worked for the Leave campaign throughout the campaign.
Can we talk about Dominic? I think he's a key figure. He's not a household name like a Gove or Farage or a Johnson. Dominic Cummings is a backroom boy, but can you just give us a little sense of who he is and his personality?
He is a demented genius. He was Michael Gove's special advisor when they were at the Department for Education. And when the Tories first got into government in the coalition in 2010, Andy Coulson, who was then David Cameron's spin doctor, said to Michael Gove, you are under no circumstances allowed to employ this man. Cummings, years before, had served as Ian Duncan Smith's chief of staff, and he stormed out after about 3 months declaring that Duncan Smith was a moron, which may or may not be an accurate judgment. But Cummings then disappeared into the fields of Durham and read a lot of books, emerged to do this work for Michael Gove, and in that government there were two or three teams of people around a sort of reforming minister. They knew what they wanted to do. They were prepared to kill any number of civil servants in order to achieve it. And Cummings drove through those education reforms. Gove had all the ideas, but Cummings was the guy who sort of made it happen and was prepared to take people out and shoot them, metaphorically, if that was the way to get it done. And so when all these kind of Eurosceptics had been fighting amongst each other for 30 years, and when they decided they needed a battle-hardened lunatic to go and run the campaign. He was the guy they went and called upon. And in January of last year, they nearly got rid of him because he was being so rude to MPs, who he thinks are morons to a man and woman. But because they didn't, he kept the focus on the campaign. He had a very small team that effectively worked together. Unlike David Cameron's side, where there was a cast of thousands, all of whom had different opinions about everything, Cummings was able to keep things religiously focused on the stuff that he thought mattered. And then halfway through the campaign, when the immigration figures came out, he persuaded Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, in Cummings' words, to take out a cricket bat and bash David Cameron on immigration. And in the end, that was what turned the campaign, I think.
He definitely comes across as this very mercurial figure, and he's a very strong figure all the way throughout the book. And I think that when future historians come to write about this period of history, that he's going to be the one I suspect they'll latch onto. Do you reckon that's fair?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I've worked in Westminster for 17 years, and he's one of the three or four most interesting people I've ever met there. And it's often the bad boys that are the interesting ones. You know what it's like with villains in movies. A chap called Damien McBride, who used to work for Gordon Brown, was a very similar character, totally understood politics, saw all the problems around the corner, and yet did very bad things in what they thought were a very good cause. But, you know, there's a sort of fascination with these guys, and they were brilliant at politics. And it's nice occasionally to meet people who are good at politics, because our political class has done quite a good job of showing us how to do it badly over the last 2 years.
One final question about Cummings. Could you glibly say, is it possible to say that actually it was he what won it for Leave?
I think if you have to pick on one person who pulled it all together, I think that's fair. I think you have to credit Nigel Farage with getting a referendum in the first place. David Cameron would never have called a referendum had he not thought that Farage was going to win the European elections in 2014, which he duly did, and would potentially have got 20% of the vote the following year in the general election had the Tories not taken a sting out of it by calling a referendum. You know, there's a triumvirate that most people sort of credit. You know, there's Farage, there's Boris Johnson, who brought, you know, his great personality and got a hearing from people who don't normally listen to Tory politicians. And then was Michael Gove, providing it with sort of intellectual respectability. But the person who brought that whole kind of thing together was Cummings, I think.
The other figure who emerges is Aaron Banks. Again, until I read your book, I'd always forgotten there was this sort of split in the Leave camps. But Banks, again, is another... He stands out as another very strong figure in the book.
Yeah, Banks is a fascinating guy. I mean, he runs an insurance business down in Bristol, and yet has become, you know, the most significant money man in British politics over the last 3 years. And, you know, if you read the book, you'll see a lot of these things that happened were completely sort of accidental or bizarre, and the involvement of Banks is one of those. He was on the verge of giving some money to the Conservative Party, and William Hague turned around and said he'd never heard of him. So Banks announced that he was going to give money instead to UKIP, and instead of giving £100,000 to the Conservative Party, he was going to give £1 million to UKIP. And that's basically how his involvement with Farage began. And then they both, you know, like causing trouble, and they both like a drink, and they got on like a house on fire. They both then got into bed with Donald Trump and all the people around him. And those two groups of people fed off each other. They learned how to do all this sort of troublemaking social media stuff, putting slightly controversial messages out there that would get publicity and attention. And every time they got called out on it, they doubled down and made things even more offensive in order to get even more publicity. And in the space of a day, they'd put up an advert, there'd be a row on the Daily Mail's website. They'd then bring it down. There'd be another story saying that they'd brought this advert down. And then, just for the hell of it, they'd put it back up, mildly more offensive. And then there'd be a third story. So there's this constant churn of news. And they both kind of got into the habit of causing as much trouble as they could to get as much attention as possible. And when you're looking at an election, as the referendum was, it was essentially about a sort of revolt against the established political classes. Having these guys around was a great success for the Leave campaign. It was very good that they didn't end up running the official campaign, because the whole thing would have collapsed to dust, as Farage said to me. You know, I mean, if we had been given the designation, God alone knows what we'd have done with it. So instead, Cummings and the official campaign were able to concentrate on sort of winning over centrists and Tory voters, while Farage went off to the north of England and got a bunch of white working class people who normally vote Labour to vote for the Leave campaign. And having those two campaigns competing and going for different voters actually helped them get over the line, I think.
You mentioned just then posters, and one of the most controversial posters was the one Breaking Point picture, which is in Tim's book. And that's a picture of a load of refugees. We must break free the EU and take control of our borders. And of course, that poster was launched just about 2-3 hours before Joe Cox is murdered. What was the kind of effect through the kind of the lobby and through Westminster when news of that came through? It was a Thursday afternoon, I think.
Well, it was an extremely shocking day because Westminster is quite a small world. There's probably about 2,000 people there in total, in terms of politicians, journalists, people who work in Whitehall departments, people who work in that sort of wider world of think tanks. And a lot of people knew Jo Cox. And even if you didn't know her, you knew people who were very moved by what had happened. And you saw an astonishing coming together. There were vigils in Parliament Square. I remember seeing Tom Watson, who is a big old bruiser, virtually in tears. I didn't know her terribly well, but I tweeted about it, and I had people coming up to me and thanking me for my tweet who did know her. And it was just a sort of a very tense, emotional day. But partly as a consequence of that, I think Westminster read that incident wrong. We assumed immediately that this would be seen as something that was likely to aid the Remain campaign. People felt that this was an act of political violence by someone on the sort of nationalist wing of British society. But the Leave campaigners immediately did focus groups and worked out that that was not going to be the case, and that people were not connecting what had happened with the campaigns, and actually were rather repelled by the idea that people would see that as somehow the consequence of the Leave campaign. And in fact, Cummings, on that day, marched straight into the sort of the main kind of war room for the Leave campaign, where his people were, you know, in a state of shock. And frankly, a lot of them felt that they had lost the referendum at that moment. And he stood on a chair and he basically said, "Don't worry, this is going to have no impact at all." And in retrospect, a lot of people in the Remain campaign actually think that it probably helped the Leave campaign, partly because it created that sense of revulsion that anyone would think this was anything to do with the referendum. But it also put the campaign in stasis for a couple of days. There was all this attention around Farage and the poster, and by the next month, by the following Monday, which was 3 or 4 days before the referendum itself, the Leave campaign's momentum, which had been building for the previous week, had stopped. And then it sort of picked up again, and it didn't seem to have that much of an effect. And what a lot of people in the Remain campaign now think is that had the Leave campaign had all the momentum into that weekend, when the markets opened on the Monday morning, it would have looked very much like Leave were well on course to win had Joe Cox not been killed. And that would have then created a market shock, which actually would then have helped the Remain campaign. As it happened, there was a sort of period of stasis, and then it continued much as it had before, where everyone who was doing polling assumed that Remain had a narrow lead, but there wasn't that sort of great sense of crisis from the point of view of the Remain campaign. So they feel that it actually didn't help them at all in the end.
Can we talk about referendum day, referendum night itself? And do you mind sharing with this small, intimate group what you thought the result would be when the polls closed?
Well, journalists try not to have too many opinions because we've got a lot of things wrong, but what you spend your afternoon doing on election days is phoning round people you hope do have some idea what's going on. And everybody you phoned that afternoon was confidently predicting a Remain victory. And if you look at the Remain campaign themselves, Andrew Cooper, who was their pollster, his internal polling for the campaign had a lead of sort of 2 or 3 points for the Remain campaign. But even Cooper himself thought that that was not accurate, and so took the extraordinary step of publishing a poll by his own polling agency, not the one he was doing for the campaign, that had a 10-point lead for Remain. And at about 10 o'clock in the evening, David Cameron had all his team together in Downing Street, eating lasagna and drinking Peroni. It's all glamour in Westminster. And Cooper phoned him up and said, you know, you're going to win by 10 points. And until the result came in Sunderland, David Cameron thought he was winning this referendum. And a large part of why he lost it is because he felt throughout that he was going to win it, and he didn't do enough to make sure that that wasn't the case.
The whole chapter on, or near chapter on referendum night is fantastically dramatic. And you could almost have a whole movie or a reconstruction of that, and it would be brilliant. And
anyone in from Hollywood, feel free to come and have a word with me later.
They're just some nice, I mean, you've got some nice photos in the book, in this edition, certainly. I think there's this scene where Dominic Cummings punches the hole in the ceiling.
Yeah, I mean, I was passed a video of Cummings' victory speech, which is a really bad sort of version on an iPhone. So the pictures are not enormous in there because the quality's not very good. But he stands up and makes this sort of rousing speech, which concludes with him sort of declaring victory for democracy. And he punches the air. Unfortunately, he was standing on a chair and the ceiling was quite low. So this ceiling tile comes flying out and sort of lands, you know, massive health and safety issue that the EU would have had a problem with. But if you're interested in watching the video, Cummings himself, on the anniversary last week, actually put it on his blog site. So you can now watch the whole thing. In my exclusive has rather been destroyed by the man himself putting the video online. But it's quite entertaining.
Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like in the Johnson camp or in Boris's home in that sort of inner sanctum that evening?
Well, I mean, Boris spent, as one of his aides put it, he spent most of the evening horizontal with his socks off, lying on a sofa, which is very Boris. And he wrote, I think, three, if not four, different speeches that night. Boris had no speech for victory prepared and was confidently hopeful of heroic failure until those results started coming in. And then at about 5 o'clock in the morning, he began to wonder whether he might be the next prime minister. And one of my favourite things that I was passed that's in there is a picture of Boris Johnson wearing a South African rugby shirt and a pair of shorts, watching David Cameron resign on his television. And it sort of captures this amazing moment where lives were completely changing. Both Boris and Gove, if you remember that press conference the next morning, Ruth Davidson had a wonderful phrase. She said they looked like a pair of teenage arsonists who were wondering why the building had burnt down. And both of them, heroically, naively, were very surprised that David Cameron had resigned. I was certain David Cameron was going to resign, and I think pretty well everybody working closely with him was certain he was going to resign if he lost the referendum. But somehow, Boris and Gove, neither of them believed that he would. And these miscalculations continued for another week, which fills up another couple of chapters. Michael Gove didn't seem to understand that if he knifed Boris Johnson, he would end up with egg on his own face as well. But, you know, if you'd asked Boris at the time what he would have wanted the outcome to be, it would have been that, you know, he would be in a senior cabinet job, preferably foreign secretary, proving that he's a serious politician and potentially the next leader of the Conservative Party. So two out of three is not bad. But Boris is this great survivor. The other revelation that I got in the book, you know, he was a great adaptable character, as we know. 24 hours before he declared for leave, he was busy writing articles for Remain, and I managed to get hold of the Boris Remain article, which is in the book as an appendix, and we ran on the front page of the Sunday Times. In fact, we ran the whole article. And Boris was not best pleased about this because it was sort of mildly embarrassing about how his mind was veering around like a shopping trolley, as he put it. And when we published this, I got a note from Boris saying, "Dear Shippers, well done, F off." Which I'm fairly sure stands for Foreign Office, but I can't be certain. He then phoned up my editor and said, You've run an article which purports to be by me, cunningly not quite claiming ownership of it at this point. You better pay me for it.
I want to talk about Michael Gove in a second, but can I just also ask, I mean, the moment a prime minister chooses to resign is always a big moment, and I think you capture that in the book, don't you? There's the mood in Number 10 that night. That's where Cameron was, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was in Number 10. And, you know, the human drama of that period is quite astonishing. You know, these are people who built long careers and had established themselves as, you know, fixtures and fittings in Westminster. And literally just like that, they're gone. And all the people that they'd got rid of, who worked for Theresa May, who they'd fallen out with, who they'd sat in cabinet, you know, laughing at her and thinking she was a bit banal and dull and not the kind of person they wanted to hang out with at their dinner parties. Suddenly they were like, sort of, it was like the end of Hamlet with, you know, corpses strewn here. And dear old Theresa May tiptoed through the wreckage and found herself as Prime Minister. All the people they'd sacked returned as her closest aides. And for 10 whole months, they commanded the scene totally and utterly in a way that I've never seen before, controlling everybody, telling off ministers. And here we are 7 weeks later, and we've got a lot more corpses on the floor again, and Theresa May clinging on by the skin of the DUP's teeth.
There's an extraordinary sentence in the book in which you write, between the 19th of February and the 30th of June, every single decision that Michael Gove made changed the course of British history. It's quite a thing, quite a big statement. I'm sure it's absolutely right. Can you just quickly talk us through some of the key decisions he did make?
Well, if Michael Gove had not backed Brexit and stuck to his principles and done what David Cameron wanted him to do and put his sort of loyalty to Cameron first, then I think there's at least a decent prospect that Boris Johnson would have found it more difficult. And Boris himself admits this. Michael Gove gave him some cover. Had Gove not done that, and had Boris gone in behind him, I think it's fairly inconceivable that Leave would have won the referendum. Had Gove then decided to run for the leadership himself, I think there's a fair chance he would have got about 160 votes in the first ballot of the Tory leadership election, and he might well have won it. Instead, he decided to back Boris Johnson, which a lot of sensible people thought was a good idea, and I don't think was necessarily a bad idea at the time. But as you know, through that week, they had a pretty dramatic falling out. And at that point, Michael Gove had a decision to make. He was the campaign manager, don't forget. And at the moment he knifed Boris, his name was still on the website as the campaign manager. We've never actually had a campaign manager doing in the candidate before in quite this way. had he instead decided and gone to Boris and said, look, we've got some problems here, you need to sort this stuff out. But had he worked with him, I think there's every chance that Boris and Theresa May would probably have got about 120 votes each in that first ballot, and they would have gone to the country. Andrea Leadsom would never have got a look in, and it's a moot point as to who would have won. I think if the campaign had gone on long enough, either Boris or Theresa May could have proved themselves unsuitable for the job. But we certainly, part of May's problem recently is that we never got a proper look at her during that contest. So there's at least a possibility that Boris and Gove together could have won that leadership contest. Instead, Gove decides to knife Boris and do it. At that point, again, he could have done it slightly differently. He could have said, I've thought about this a lot. My friends have prevailed on me. I'm going to run. I've got a lot of time for Boris. It'll be a fair fight. At that point, either Boris or Gove could still have been leader of the Conservative Party, not Theresa May. Instead, Gove decided to knife Boris and do it in such a way that Boris didn't have time to gather his troops, to collect his thoughts, and perhaps to carry on, which at least a week later Boris wished he had. Instead, he did it in such a brutal way that Boris was finished and that he himself was finished. And the supreme misjudgment in all of this, for me, is that one. All the people who were in the sort of cocoony bubble with Michael Gove while all that was happening were saying, go for it, Michael. This is the right thing to do. And they got themselves into a position where there was a sort of inexorable logic to doing what they did. The people who weren't in that bubble, and they included Dominic Cummings, actually, and a chap called Paul Stevenson, who had been the director of communications for Vote Leave and is one of the best comms guys I've ever met, both of them told him it was a mistake. And when they had a conference call at 7 o'clock on the morning of the knifing, Paul Stevenson said to Michael Gove, if you do this, you'll be Ed Miliband times 100. He knifed his brother, this will be much worse. And Gove didn't grasp that that was the case. In the end, he had enough friends to rally round and get him 45 votes in that first ballot, but he wasn't going anywhere after that. So each and every one of those decisions by Gove made things go differently, it seems to me.
The result was a big shock, and you devote a whole chapter to the reasons why you think it went the way it did. I don't really want to go into that now. I think people could read that. I think it's too long an answer. But there's one reason, surely, comes in the form of a man we haven't yet spoken about, and that's Nigel Farage. I mean, 2 decades of campaigning to get to this point, and yet never even won South Thanet. It is an extraordinary story.
Yeah, I mean, Aaron Banks says about Nigel Farage, how extraordinary to be the most successful politician of your generation and never get elected, which, you know, Farage has tried 7 times to get into the House of Commons and has failed on each and every one of them. But it's hard to not to conclude that the one thing he was interested in pursuing is the, you know, the signal event of our political lives. And as I said earlier, I think there would not have been a referendum without Nigel Farage. And I don't think it could have been won without Nigel Farage. I don't think he was as big a player as he thinks he was. But, you know, he's a very significant character. And what we've seen since is that having accomplished that one thing, he's, I think, twice more resigned as the leader of UKIP since. I think there's every prospect that he'll return again this autumn. And, we can see him stand for the 4th time as leader. But it's not a conventional political career, but given what he cared about, you would have to conclude it's been a successful one.
On a personal level, does Farage sort of play the same game as when you're talking to another senior politician?
Farage is a bit different. He tends to tell it like it is all the time. And actually, he's almost more extravagant when you turn the tape recorder on than he is when you're just talking to him. The great secret about Nigel Farage is that if you're having sort of a cosy private chat with him, he can be as endearingly banal as almost anybody else. The second you put the tape recorder on, out comes the pint, the cigar, and a series of florid anecdotes. I don't need to go into great detail to tell you that that is not the case with Theresa May. I've had half-hour interviews with Theresa May that have lasted for 6 hours.
I'm not going to ask you about interviewing her because she's still Prime Minister and you probably want to keep...
Oh, I don't know.
Go on, she's tough, is she?
Tough? I mean, blood out of a stone would be, would be a good thing. It's like chiselling diamonds out of a granite rock with a plastic spoon trying to get Theresa May to open up, but...
And that was her problem with the election, wasn't it? Is that the public started feeling that, didn't they?
Well, I think at the start of the campaign, a lot of people sort of projected their hopes and dreams onto Theresa May, and the more they looked at her, the more they were questioning whether that was the correct judgment. The paradox of the campaign we've just seen is that they put at the centre of it, you know, conspicuously and consciously, a politician who really doesn't like the limelight at all. I thought Chris Patton had a good phrase for it at the weekend. He said it's a bit like a doctor that's frightened of the sight of blood, having a prime minister who's not keen on the sight of journalists or members of the public. That may be a sound judgment where journalists are concerned, but it doesn't help you win elections if you take the same view about the general public.
The subtitle of the hardback was How Brexit Sunk Britain's Political Class. Has it been sunk by Brexit?
Well, I mean, we shortened it on the paperback to the full story of Brexit because it sounded a little bit pompous. But and I got when I do events, people say, well, it didn't sink the whole political class. Look, they're all still going strong. But, half the people who benefited a year ago are now finished as well. So there's a sort of continuing problem with the political class. And actually, I think unless they get a grip on it, they're going to find that... it may be more wide-reaching than just a few individuals losing their jobs. I think one of the conclusions you can draw from the general election is that quite a lot of the population that was angry and voting for Brexit is still pretty angry about the fact that they feel left out and ignored by senior politicians, and they don't feel that the economy is set up for them, and they don't feel that some of the benefits of living in Britain are coming their way. And so I think potentially, you know, that original subtitle might in time prove to be more apt than the one we've changed it to. So my mistake.
I think the other thing that people didn't anticipate was the sheer division through the population that Brexit caused. I mean, you know, members of households are voting in different ways. Certainly that was true of my parents and I. We voted in different ways. They're here somewhere. It's all pretty good tempered. And there was, I mean, you had, I think your wife was working for Remain while you were writing stories about Turkish.
Yeah, my wife was head of events for the Remain campaign, and after the great triumph of Brexit, went off to work for Hillary Clinton. So she had quite the summer. made much better, obviously, by me writing a book about where it all went wrong for her career, and spending our entire summer holiday doing it. The highlight for me was, I think, 2 weekends before polling day, I got hold of a bunch of leaked Foreign Office cables, which suggested that David Cameron hadn't been quite telling the truth about Turkish accession to the EU and what we might do with Turkish passport holders. That story went down like a cup of cold sick, it's fair to say, and I was summarily kicked out of the marital bed for 48 hours. So it had far-reaching consequences in a range of ways. And the other thing was your friends and contacts. You know, you have people, you know, on both sides. And normally in a general election, people say, oh, who do you want to win? And I would say any politician that answers the telephone. So that means you have your friends, you know, in all the different parties. And if they're sitting MPs, they can all technically win. You know, it doesn't normally pan out quite like that. But with the referendum, you had, you know, really people you'd known, you know, well for 10 years on both sides. And some, you know, there is no hung parliament in a referendum. It's total defeat or total victory, and a lot of people found that quite hard to take.
I've got two more questions for you, Tim, and then we're going to put it to the floor. Towards the end of the book, you quote Chiu Enlai when he says, in 1972, it's still too early to say what the French Revolution meant. And of course, one of the problems with being a historian is trying to work out what these massive events mean. You have a stab at it. Do you mind having another stab at it here? What you think Brexit means?
Well, I think it's probably the thing that we're all going to look back on our deathbeds as the most significant political moment. And I think part of it is caused by the economic crash in 2008. And I think we're still seeing the aftershocks of that. When it happened, I think a lot of people felt that 9/11 was going to be the most dramatic event in our lives. Yes, we're still seeing some of the aftershocks of that. But I think in terms of British society, as opposed to this kind of, you know, irritant of terrorism, I think Britain will be reshaped much more by Brexit than and by the consequences of that crash than it will be by 9/11. So I think potentially, it's something that, you know, joining the EU shaped 40 years of British history, and leaving it will probably shape at least 40 more, I would have thought.
You did mention that you are now working on a next book. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Well, the original plan was just to update the first book for the paperback, so you all had another reason to buy it. There's an index. That's a good reason to buy this one. But I was literally about to hand that in, and then Theresa May called the election, so we decided to do another book. And I think sort of I was quite grateful that HarperCollins were going to give me a little bit of money just to write another book. I didn't have any great expectation that it would be very interesting, but now we have a fairly extraordinary story to tell again, and I've got about 5 weeks to interview another 50 people and write another 100,000 words. So, gulp.
Well, it's good that you've come down here, and please go and make his day even longer by making him sign your book, which you're going to go and buy. So thank you, Tim.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.